Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast, brought to you by Travel Bag, creating holidays packed full of exciting memories since 1979. If there's one thing cricket is good at, it's enjoying dead rubbers, meaningless games without context. Today's game between Sri Lanka and West Indies was the first such contest of the World Cup. Sri Lanka picks up their third CWC19 win, while West Indies are left in ninth place after eight games. I'm Yaz Rana, and today I'm joined by Wisden's Ben Gardner on the phone. How are you, Ben?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. You're exactly right. When the rubbers go dead, we come alive.
Absolutely. Did you have a moment of the day?
Yeah, I did. It came right at the end. It was Angelo Matthews bowling his first ball in ODI cricket, and so we're told, his first ball in any sort of cricket, the nets, a match, anything, for 8 months. Just ambles up, probably about 69 miles an hour, who knows, and nicks off poor Annie, batting like a dream, 118 first ball, and wins the game for Sri Lanka. And I guess, so there was no injury thing, it wasn't like, it wasn't that sort of thing where they were trying to make up the overs. Kareena just felt that Bandisay was going for a few too many. He bowled over himself, Kareena. And I think that sums up Sri Lanka's tournament in a way. I mean, they came in with not much expectations, no sort of great designs on winning the whole thing, but I think just through sort of cobbling together, they've put together a pretty decent campaign where they've sort of stayed in contention for a long time, got more wins than I think almost everyone would have said they would ahead of the tournament. I mean, if you look at the players that have stood up, is like Malinga, who was out of the side not long ago and thought his international career was done. The lead spinner has been Dhananjaya Silva, who's a test match number three and a part-timer. It's not really made any sense, but as they've left a sort of indelible mark on this tournament, and we've got them all to thank for making it exciting, I guess.
I was really critical of their squad before the tournament was announced. I mean, remarkably, in October 2018, they beat England by 200-odd runs in an ODI. And only three of that 11 actually made it to the World Cup. Kareena Ratne hadn't played an ODI for 4 years. I mean, Avishka Fernando today was brilliant. He scored his first international 100. He's been one of the few breakout players of the tournament. There haven't been many breakout players, but he's definitely been one of them. So my question, Ben, is where's he been if he's this good?
Well, I mean, I think there's more of the story to come of where he's been. There's been sort of a bit of stuff coming out that there was illness basically that was stopping him from playing, and I mean, I guess you don't know what that could mean without more info. It's not good to speculate, but I think that I think the thing is that he came in at a very young age. He was what, 18, and playing his first List Day game when he made his debut,
yeah,
against Australia,
crazy.
And opening the batting and got bowled by Mitchell Starc, obviously. But I think that shows that they raised him. And I sort of feel that the only reason they didn't give him more of a chance is because of external circumstance, rather than they then thought, oh, he's not good enough, he's going to prove himself. Because that's not really how Sri Lanka do things. You look at Kusum Mendes, he gets a really long rope. You look at, even going back, players like Kumar Sangakkara at the beginning of their careers didn't have astonishing starts, were sort of averaging 30s for a while and then exploded. I think that's Sri Lanka like to identify players early and give them a long rope. And they're pretty good at it, and those players tend to, I mean, as we see with Malinga and Matthews, they tend to flourish much later on in their careers, and he could well be one who we sort of, like, we're still talking about in a long time, I think.
Yeah. Quite oddly, Sangakkara on commentary today said that Sri Lankan selectors need to give young players more of a chance, and sometimes young players do well and they're quite quickly dropped. I'm not really sure that's the case. Kusum Mendes, who looks brilliant, has played the odd brilliant innings. He's been given so many opportunities and he's been allowed to develop on the international stage. What do you think is next for Fernando? I mean, his domestic record is actually not that impressive. Do you think that he will be drafted into the test team at the first available opportunity?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think there's loads of heed paid to Sri Lankan domestic record sometimes. I mean, I think it's not unfair to say that their setup leaves a little bit to be desired. I mean, there's sort of part-time spinners there who are sort of taking loads and loads of wickets. I think all finger spinners basically the top wicket takers there. So I think you kind of have to go on other things based on it to see if they're going to make it at the top level, and he seems to have it basically. I think I'll do that. I was just thinking, it was interesting what you said about the this not being the tournament for breakout stars, and it's been the tournament for the old stage really, for your Malingas and your Matthews and your Wahab Riazes. And I guess that's what, I mean, I know that the players Shalantian's picked didn't have loads of ODI experience as well, which is what made it all the more bizarre, but they at least were established international players, and I guess
they have kind of just coped with the pressure of the World Cup reasonably well, which is why they've had a decent tournament in the end.
They've surpassed everyone's expectations. They've kind of stumbled upon what is actually a pretty solid top five. Pereira, Karuna Ratne, Fernando, Mendes, Matthews is actually that's a strong top five. Fernando, I think his hook shot is so good. He hit Kotchul for a brilliant six today, 89 miles per hour, and he hit Jofra Archer for two sixes in that game. And if England get knocked out, by the way, on Wednesday against New Zealand, I think we'll look back at Fernando's 49 against England as like the turning point in their campaign. Sranka were 3 for 2, all over Sranka, and Fernando played this quite brilliant counter-attacking 49 that changed the momentum of that game. Ben,
just think about all the brilliant players the batsmen that were in that game, and he was the only one to get to grips with that victory. I guess Ben Stokes sort of towards the end, but I mean, yeah, it really stood out because of how everyone else struggled, not just because of the final result, if that makes sense. Yeah, it was a
Yeah, absolutely. He wasn't the only young person to score their first international 100 today. Nicholas Puran, who has also looked really good in the tournament without leaving a game-defining innings until today. He was superb. He scored his first 100 in all professional cricket. And he's another one who perhaps could have seen more of before if it weren't for injury.
Yeah, so I think it was a few years ago he was involved in a really bad car crash, and there were times after that when he couldn't move either of his legs. He had to have some quite serious surgeries. So he's another one, exactly, we'd have seen more of him, and it's not a mark of his talent or lack of that he hasn't played till now. It's just been circumstance. I think we can expect to see a lot of him. It remains to be seen whether that'll be in T20 cricket or whether that'll be in Test cricket for the West Indies, but I mean, he, as far as you can tell, he looks like a player who has the game for it. I mean, I don't know if the temperament is there yet, I guess. I mean, there have been a few times sort of maybe sort of thrown it away, and then today as well, in sight of, I mean, actually you could sort of forgive him in sight of his first professional 100, but he sort of ran out Fabian Allen, which, as much as that that Matthews wicket put the seal on the defeat, that was the moment that, like, the game turned, because Allen was batting brilliantly. He got to a 30 ball 50, and yeah, Boyle on 99 sort of was desperate to get this 100, so he set off, and then was desperate not to get out on 99, so turned back and was completely sold his mate down the river. And a brilliant talent, and it's playing brilliant, and you've got to give the credit to Graham Swan. He said it all those weeks ago in our first podcast, said that he'd seen him in the CPL or the IPL, and he was something special, and he was been bang on, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he never scored a professional 100 until today, and he was still being selected as West Indies number four in a World Cup, kind of suggests that people think there's something special about him. You don't get have people batting four without professional hundreds that often, so there must be something different about him. West Indies are in ninth place. They haven't won a game in over a month, but it hasn't felt like they've played that badly. They've been close in some games. Ben, where do you think they've gone wrong?
I think the close thing can't really be underestimated, because it is a tournament where, as much as it's a long group stage, you're also, like, a few bad results can really put you out of it. And I think that the real clincher was the one against Australia, where they were pretty close, and then Mitchell Starc came in and cleaned up the tail, and that was that, basically. But just the way they talk about that in every press conference now, they kind of say, if that Australia game had gone differently. And I think as much as it set them back on the points table, it just completely sucked any of the wind out of their sails of the momentum from the England series before that, and from that game against Pakistan, and then obviously the close game against New Zealand, and again today. But I guess also the Bangladesh game showed something else. When, so it was the short ball that had done it against Pakistan, and then against Bangladesh they tried to go short, and against, like, Shakib is a brilliant player of the short ball, it was kind of never going to work. But you saw in that game, Andre Russell, he was bowling a lot of short balls, bowling quickly, his knees kind of finally gave out, and it was heartbreaking to see, because he was there on the field, like, just not able to even fall over after the ball, just because he hoped if he could maybe stick it out, he could bowl that one more over and maybe get the wicket. And it's clear that he cares so much, and it has meant so much to all of them. I think almost the fact that it's meant so much and been building up to it, I think, because it came all of a sudden that they suddenly had a chance to do something when going wrong, it went wrong quite quickly, I guess. But, I mean, yeah, they could easily have, if that Bangladesh game gone their way and then they'd won the three close ones, they could be semi-final contenders. And there's the core of a really good team there, really good batsman lineup especially. So all is not lost. And I hope that they kind of recognise that when they go home and evaluate that this hasn't been the awful tournament it looks like in the points table, I guess.
It's quite a positive reflection of the competitiveness of the tournament that a team this good is likely to finish ninth.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, all they are is one wrist spinner, a seamer, just a little bit of guile, I guess, and the batsmen just gotten away from being real contenders.
I was looking at the table today, and Sri Lanka, before this game, were out of contention for the top four spaces because the most points they could finish on was 10, and England are on 10 points. But because Sri Lanka had two rained off games, they could not have as many wins as England. And if teams are on equal points, it goes to games won before net run rate. And that's actually quite harsh because if Sri Lanka had won today, which they did, and they win their last game against India, they'll end up with a win percentage of 57%, which is better than what England's would be if England finished on 10 points, which would be 55%, which seems a bit harsh. Ben, is that an oversight from the tournament organisers there, that a team with a better win percentage can be knocked out basically just because they had two games rained off?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of double-edged sword that it's more losses if you finish on the same points as someone else. I guess the thing is that, like, in cricket, there's not going to be a perfect solution, as there is obviously in football with goal difference, because you don't get a single type of margin of victory. You don't get runs or wickets. Like, they could go with net run rate, but we've seen before how that throws up some odd results, like in the 2015 World Cup when New Zealand beat Australia by one wicket in what was obviously a really close game, but in 25 overs, so they got a huge boost in their net run rate. And I think what you're looking for in a differentiator is something that... I want to talk about something else first. There's something else people have suggested as a potential tiebreaker, which is using DLS, because you can get a margin of victory in terms of runs. You'll see it if there's a chase ended before the team has a chance to actually get the runs, and it will say they've won by 16 runs because they're this much ahead of the DLS pass score. And you can actually use that to get a runs margin in any chase, so that you can get a runs margin in any game. But the problem with that is, if you bowl a team out for 50, say, and then chase it down in 5 overs, you've obviously delivered an absolute hammering, but you have only won by at most 50 runs, which doesn't sound that close. So that's also not a perfect solution. So I guess, yeah, I don't have one, but it's definitely something that should be figured out, and that I'm sure they can figure out.
Net run rate does add an interesting dimension to the tournament, though. I mean, West Indies and New Zealand picked up enormous victories in the first few games of the tournament that has had a very long-lasting effect on their net run rate. It's effectively given them an extra point. New Zealand's net run rate is excellent. Pakistan's is awful, largely down to that defeat to the West Indies on day two of the tournament. Do you understand how net run rate works? Because the commentators definitely don't.
Yeah, no, well, I do, but I've looked into it, and I have a maths degree. I won't give the explanation out. I'm sure there's easy things to it's out there, but it is sort of counterintuitive in more than just the fact that it takes a bit of calculation to do in that. So I'll try and explain how this works in my head. Is that if you want a tiebreak between teams, you want it to get a level of sort of dominance, I guess, in the games that they've won, because obviously just looking at the wins and losses hasn't cut it. And the thing with net run rate is, it, putting aside the other stuff about wickets lost, is it gets you dominance per ball, if that makes sense, because it's like just the overs minus the overs, which means that if you win a 20 over game heavily, it's going to impact your net run rate less if you win a 50 over game heavily, which to me doesn't make sense, I guess. I think it should be down to each game and how good you were in each game, rather than how good you were over all the balls you've bowled and batted, if that makes sense. I think there is a way to do it in that you could take the net run rate for each game and add and subtract that, and that would also have the nice effect, which some commentators misunderstand, that if you win a game, your net run rate would go up, and if you lose it, your net run rate would go down. That is at least a small change I can see that would improve the system a little bit and take out some of the sort of more confusing aspects of it. But yeah, I don't know. Do you understand it, Yaz?
Oh, well, not really, but thank you. I mean, cricket is a complicated game, but I think net run rate is the most complicated part of what is one of the more complicated sports. The Women's Ashes starts today. England looking to regain them for the first time since 2014. Australia probably go into the tournament as favourites. Australia scored 340 against a strong England Academy side the other day, which was basically an England Lions side. Ben, they go in favourites for you, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess slight question mark. It's not even a question mark. It's just because she's so important. Is Meg Lanning in her form? She's only got two ODI 50s. Since the 2017 World Cup. I mean, Elise Pearce is in the form of her life, so you sort of you can't look too strongly into that as a kind of point of weakness. So I guess the other thing is, I'm not sure if Australia know exactly what is their best batting lineup. I mean, they did win those two academy games really comfortably, but they were playing quite a different batting lineup from each one. I don't they know especially who their opening partnership should be. If it will be Rachel Haynes, who has in the New Zealand series, if it will be Nicole Bolton, or Beth Mooney's another candidate, and I think Alyssa Healy's the mainstay up there. So there's sort of things that England maybe will look at and they can exploit, and obviously have some brilliant players of their own. I mean, Australia have got their own as strong favourites, I think.
What about players that we might not have seen shine on the bigger stage before, who we might see shine over the next few weeks?
Yeah, I think there's two or three that stand out. I guess from Australia, the two are Georgia Wareham, who's a leggy, and she's keeping a man. Anyone who watched the Women's Ashes down under last time will know what a brilliant bowler she is. And so to keep her at the side, is she must be something really special. So it would be really interesting how she goes. And the other one is Taylor Vlemmink, I think we're going with,
who has
had a lot of injuries, but is properly rapid. She's some people think she might be the fastest bowler Australia ever, which is obviously a high accolade, because I'm quite young and it sounds like bristle shoulders, but she could be. She might not play every game. She might not play many games at all. But it'll be definitely like vast when she is playing. And for England, I think the two to watch are two that aren't actually in the initial squad. They've gone with sort of a tried and tested squad for the ODIs. Fran Wilson is the one, not surprised, but the one who hasn't played so much in there. But she's been in brilliant form, and we've seen what she can do in there. She was a key part of that World Cup campaign. But the two I think might come in are Bryony Smith and Sophia Dunkley, who have both been in brilliant form for their county sides, and Bryony Smith also for the academy side. I think they maybe see them as T20 specialists, and if it comes to if England are making changes after the Test match, it'll be because they have ground to make up, and so they need to win that series or even win all three. Bringing those two in will be a real it'll be a real test of what they can do. It'll be really, really exciting because they're two players who I think might well be the bedrock of England's side for years to come.
The timing of the Ashes is unfortunate in a way. It's starting just as the World Cup reaches the business end. I mean, it's been a long tournament, but we're getting to the most interesting bit of the World Cup, and as a result, the Ashes is kind of started under the radar and is not perhaps getting the attention that it really deserves.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I guess it's such a busy summer with a Men's World Cup, two big women's series and six Test matches that I don't know how much choice they really had. And I wonder also, I mean, with the format of the World Cup, if England had beaten Sri Lanka, it would all be basically done and dusted by now, and maybe there could be a bit more focus on it. But as it is, everyone's still firmly seeing if England are going to qualify. I guess the good thing is that Test match is going to be such an event, is like got its own little window, and that when it can just be on Sky for the 4 days and anyone wants to watch cricket will have to watch that, and that is really exciting, because I mean it's a huge moment for the women's Test game, I guess, because this is the only Test they play now, and there's a lot of people saying that they, or a lot of, at least prominent voices saying they should be playing more, and an exciting Test match on TV when it's the only thing that's on would be a really big for that case, I guess.
I feel very sorry for the players playing in the Test match, because in any other game of professional cricket, there isn't pressure on the players to perform to be a part of a spectacle as much as a women's test match, because it's so, there are so few of them nowadays, there's kind of a pressure for it to be an entertaining game, and people's opinions of whether there should be more or fewer women's test matches are almost entirely based off one game every 2 years. So I basically, that's unfair for players to have to handle as well as playing the biggest games of their careers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's hard to overstate kind of just how different it is when you don't play any sort of multi-day cricket in, like, in any form of cricket, not just international. So I mean, because if you kind of think about it, when you're playing ODIs and T20s, you can get by never trying to get a batter out, if that makes sense, because you can always just be restricting runs. You never have to, like, hold that perfect ball that, like, sort of pitch went off and then seems away and just clips the edge of the bat and goes to slip. You can get by just sort of, you know, by getting runs. And the same with batting. You never have to just set out your stall and bat forever, because there's always that time limit on it. I think you see, especially almost with the batting, that they can't, it's the natural thing that when you have forever to bat, it seems, you go a bit slower than you would otherwise. Not so otherwise, but slower than ideal for the format. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, it's really hard on the players, but they all pretty much say that they want to play more and that they love playing them. And I mean, it's a bit of a slap in the face, I think, really, for everyone to talk about how Test cricket in men's cricket is the pinnacle, and then say to women, basically, no, you can't really play that. I think that they have to play more if we're taking it seriously. And there was actually a suggestion given to me by Adam Collins, Australian writer, and been on this podcast, I think, that you can do basically women's Ashes format for all cricket around the world, because they already have the ICC Women's ODI Championship, and you just extend that to all three formats, and every tour is basically two ODIs, a test match, and three T20s, and, like, you have it there, basically. And I think that's a really good suggestion, and is one that if I were in charge, I would try and look into, but I'm not. So.
A very reasonable suggestion, but yeah, as you say, you're not in charge yet, Ben. Yeah, not yet. We've got a question from one of our regular listeners, Richard Joyce. It's a good question. Out of interest, since you didn't discuss it on yesterday's podcast, is there an argument for Moeen and Plunkett to be picked for England ahead of Rashid? I get the latter's quality and his ceiling is higher, but he seems far from his best. 7 wickets in 8 games at 57, going at 5.84 runs per over and a wicket every 59.14 balls. Moeen is only marginally better in the stats department and generally outperformed with a bat, but he at least offers the possibility of more power down the order if it comes off, and arguably bowling a little bit better, albeit Rashid offers greater variation. Just a thought. What do you think about Richard's thought, Ben?
Yeah, I think I've taught myself around on it, really. I think when I first heard it, I was sort of like, no, you can't drop Rashid, he's so important. But I think there's a couple of things. One, there's so many of those players that England have now. And I think the other thing is, he's right that there's not much between their bowling at the moment. There's probably also not much between their batting, really. So I mean, you're not losing much or gaining much picking either at the moment based on World Cup form. But what you do lose when you pick Mo is a slightly different type of bowler that England don't have in their other options. I mean, what she does brilliantly is take wickets in the middle overs. But if England, as they would in this scenario, I think, pick all four of Archer, Wokes, Plunkett and Wood, especially in Wood and Plunkett, you have two bowlers whose USP is their sort of middle overs strike taking, the wicket taking ability, whereas you don't have a guy who can come on and just rattle through three overs at 16 or 17 or whatever. You've got that bit of unpredictability with Rashid, which Moeen is maybe a slightly more consistent bowler and has been bowling really well, I think. So yeah, I think there definitely is an argument. I don't think it's the thing that's going to make or break England's World Cup campaign, but it's a definitely interesting one to discuss. What would you say? What's your opinion?
I mean, over the last 4 years, Rashid has been indispensable for England, but he's not bowling at 100%. Ben Jones said yesterday that perhaps his injured shoulder is affecting his ability to bowl googlies, particularly to left-handers, and he seems to be bowling fewer googlies than he normally does. If that is the case and he's not bowling at 100%, then yeah, I would be open to changing things. It's a difficult one. I would be hesitant to drop Rashid, though. He's been so good for England for so long. But I have been surprised that he's played every game in the World Cup because of that shoulder injury. It's been troubling him for, what, 6-7 weeks now. But I think the big game changer here is Mark Wood's form. Mark Wood, I think he's always been a player for me that the idea of him has always been better than reality. But since St Lucia, that test match in February, he's been a completely different bowler to what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years in an England shirt. He's bowling 90 miles plus consistently, and he's playing game after game. I mean, I can't believe he's played as much in this World Cup as he has done. And it's his consistency that's changed things. That, I mean, before the World Cup, I don't think anyone would have really seen. I think everyone would have presumed that Moeen would have played every game. They would have presumed that Rashid would play every game. The fact that Moeen's not playing at the moment and Rashid's spot is even under question, even a little bit, I think is a reflection of how well Wood has done as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, but you're right about not resting Rashid as well. I think he would have missed a trick, not just there, but with not playing Tom Curran, which took the in the Pakistan series, and he hasn't got a look in and just could have got some more cup experience under his belt. But also, I mean, you might want to pick with someone. I mean, Wood could yet get injured, someone could yet get injured, and then you bring in Tom Curran cold to a World Cup semi-final or what have you. But I mean, it's amazing to see Mark Wood bowling and bowling quick. I mean, he's just a lovely bloke as well as a furious bowler. So it's great.
Cheers for the question, Richard. If you want to ask a question to the panel, get in touch on Twitter with the hashtag AskWisden, A-S-K with a capital A and Wisden with a capital W. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's I know it's late. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This has been the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast, brought to you by Travel Bag, creating exciting holidays packed full of memories since 1979.